A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
I was talking to an electrician yesterday, a guy who's in the trade full time, and we got onto where he buys parts. He likes his local hardware stores, knows the people, but when it comes to actually finding niche components, he told me flat out, buying locally is a waste of time. Which is basically what Daniel's been saying for years, only Daniel's not a tradesperson. Daniel sent us a whole thing about this, and it's got layers. He had one of those grumpy fastener store experiences recently. You walk in for a handful of screws and the clerk acts like you've ruined her morning, and it flipped him around to the seller's perspective. Selling fasteners must be miserable. Hundreds of sizes, customers who don't know what they need, tiny margins. So his question is, at what point do we admit certain types of stores are just inherently inefficient, and if we do, what replaces them? He's not talking about all retail, but the specific category where the economics don't work and the customer experience is bad anyway. And he points out that AliExpress has built a supply chain that can sell direct to consumer at a scale local stores can't touch, which raises the ethical problem. Small businesses employ people. They're part of communities, and losing them feels like a real loss, even if the efficiency argument is sound.
The thing that jumps out at me is the detail Daniel buried in the middle. He said he prefers ordering online not because of price, but because he doesn't want to subject a sales assistant to his in-depth research over fasteners. That's not what most people assume about online shopping. Everyone thinks it's about saving money, but what he's describing is the absence of social pressure. He can spend 40 minutes comparing thread pitches without someone hovering.
I've done that exact thing. Stood in an aisle staring at little plastic bags while a guy with a name tag slowly loses the will to live.
Right, and that's a real driver. The research backs this up. When you ask people why they shop online for hardware and home improvement, price is in the mix, but it's not number one. It's the ability to research at your own pace, the variety, and not having to interact with anyone until you click buy. Daniel's electrician friend is a full-time pro who still prefers online for niche parts, and that tells you something. This isn't amateurs who don't know better.
So let's unpack what Daniel's really asking here. It's not just about fasteners. It's about the whole logic of retail when the supply chain behind it's been rebuilt from the ground up.
And the core tension is straightforward. On one side, consumer efficiency, getting exactly what you want, cheaper, without leaving your house. On the other side, community value, the local store as a place, as an employer, as someone who can hand you the right thing when your pipe bursts. AliExpress sharpens this because their efficiency isn't incremental. It's structural.
Let's trace it in three pieces. First, why the tradesperson's preference makes sense. Second, the mechanics of how AliExpress pulls this off, because there's a specific regulatory piece that supercharges the whole thing. Third, the harder question, what do we do about it, ethically and practically?
The regulatory piece is the de minimis loophole. This is where a lot of the conversation should start, but usually doesn't. In the US, imports valued under $800 bypass duties and taxes entirely. No customs fees, no processing. A package from Shenzhen lands at your door as if it came from across town. That threshold was raised from $200 back in 2016, and it fundamentally changed the economics of direct-to-consumer shipping from China.
$800 isn't a fastener order. That's a lot of room.
It's enormous. For context, the EU's threshold was 150 euros until very recently, and they're now moving to eliminate it entirely for certain categories. The US number is wildly generous, and AliExpress, Temu, Shein, they've built their entire consumer model around it. Every single package slips through tax-free.
So, that's the first thing local retail is up against. They pay import duties on their wholesale stock. They pay property tax on the storefront. They pay staff. AliExpress pays none of that on the consumer side.
And that's before we even talk about the supply chain itself. Let's get inside the electrician's head first, because that's where Daniel's prompt starts.
Why does online actually win for someone who does this every day?
The obvious answer is variety. A local hardware store stocks maybe 200 fastener screws if they're well equipped. AliExpress has tens of thousands. If you need an M4.5 by 16mm stainless countersunk hex socket screw, the local store doesn't have it and probably can't order it in less than a week. AliExpress has 17 listings.
And the electrician knows this before he walks in. He's already done the mental math. Drive to the store, park, walk in, scan the aisle, realize they don't have it, ask the clerk, wait while they check the back, come up empty, drive home, order it online anyway. He's lost an hour.
The second piece is the one Daniel named, the social dynamic, standing in front of a wall of little drawers while a sales assistant waits. Not because they're impatient necessarily, but because their presence creates a clock. You feel like you need to decide quickly, and that's exactly the wrong way to buy fasteners. Fasteners reward deliberation, wrong thread pitch, and you drilling new holes or making a second trip.
I once bought the wrong wall anchors 3 times in 1 day because I kept rushing. The 4th trip, the guy just looked at me.
And that's the thing, the clerk doesn't want you there either. Which brings us to the seller's side, and this is where Daniel's prompt gets genuinely interesting. He flicked the lens. Most people complain about the grumpy clerk and stop there. Daniel thought, wait, why is she grumpy? And the answer is structural.
Walk me through the math of selling fasteners.
Let's take a typical independent hardware store. Fasteners are low margin per unit. A single screw might sell for 15 cents, cost the store 8 cents wholesale, 7 cents of gross profit. But that screw occupies a slot in a drawer in a cabinet that takes up floor space. The store pays rent on that square footage. Someone had to order that screw, receive it, stock it, and now someone has to stand there while the customer squints at it.
7 cents doesn't buy you a lot of squinting.
It buys you none. The high SKU count is what kills it. You're not stocking one screw, you're stocking 400 types of screw, each in multiple sizes. The inventory carrying cost is enormous relative to the revenue. And then the customer arrives and they're not sure what they need. They hold up 2 bolts and ask the difference. The clerk spends 5 minutes helping, and the total sale is $3.40. The margin on that sale might be $1.20. If the clerk is making $15 an hour, you've just spent $1.25 of labor cost to make $1.20 in margin. Before rent, before utilities, before the cost of the inventory sitting there for 6 months.
So the store is paying the customer for the privilege of selling them screws.
On the marginal transaction, yes. The only way fastener sales make sense is if they're a loss leader that brings people in who then buy higher margin items. But for a specialty fastener store, the kind Daniel walked into, there's no higher margin item. The fasteners are the business.
And that's why the clerk is grumpy. She's not a bad person. She's trapped in a transaction that makes nobody happy and loses money while doing it.
There's a broader point here about what efficiency actually means in retail. We tend to think of an inefficient store as one that's poorly managed. Bad inventory control, surly staff, dated displays. But what Daniel's describing is structural inefficiency. The business model itself can't work at the scale it operates, no matter how well it's run. The best manager in the world can't make a 7-cent screw profitable when it takes 5 minutes to sell.
And that distinction matters because it changes the ethical question. If a store is failing because the owner is bad at business, that's one thing. If it's failing because the economics are impossible, that's different. That's not a failure of execution. That's a category problem.
Now layer in what AliExpress is doing on the other side. This is where the efficiency gap becomes unbridgeable.
So the mechanics are clear. AliExpress has built a machine that local stores can't match. But that raises the harder question. What do we do about it?
Let me lay out the machine first, because the specifics are worth understanding. AliExpress isn't a retailer in the traditional sense. It's a marketplace that connects Chinese manufacturers directly to consumers worldwide. The manufacturer lists the product, sets the price, and when you order, it ships from their facility, often from a centralized warehouse that aggregates inventory from dozens of factories.
So they're cutting out every intermediary. No distributor, no wholesaler, no retailer. Factory to doorstep.
Factory to doorstep, and the shipping is subsidized by international postal agreements that date back decades. The Universal Postal Union sets terminal dues, the fees postal services pay each other for delivering international mail. For years, China was classified as a developing country under those agreements, which meant its outbound shipping rates were artificially low. That's been partially reformed, but the rates are still far below what a domestic retailer pays to ship across town.
So the Chinese government was effectively subsidizing AliExpress shipping through the postal system.
Through the postal classification system, yes. And that's on top of the de minimis loophole. You've got no import duties, no sales tax collected at point of purchase in most cases, and shipping that costs less than it actually costs to move the package. A set of fasteners that would cost $12 at a local store, if they even have them, arrives from Shenzhen for $3.50 with free shipping.
The local store can't compete on price, can't compete on variety, and this is the part people miss. Increasingly can't compete on speed either.
That's the shift. AliExpress shipping used to take 6 weeks. Now it's often 10 to 14 days, and they're building out logistics hubs in Europe and North America to get that down to under a week. For a niche part you don't need today, the wait is irrelevant. The electrician Daniel talked to, he's not running to the store for emergency supplies. He's stocking his van and planning jobs. He can wait 10 days for the exact right component.
And if he does need something today, he's probably still going to the local store. But that emergency purchase isn't enough to keep the store alive. It's the regular planned purchases that make the business work, and those are the ones migrating online.
The scale economics get even starker when you look at manufacturing. A factory in Shenzhen producing M5 bolts can run a line that outputs 100,000 units a day. They supply the domestic market, they supply industrial buyers, and whatever's left goes on AliExpress at near marginal cost. The local hardware store is buying from a wholesaler who bought from a distributor who bought from an importer who bought from that same factory. 4 layers of markup before it hits the shelf.
Each layer has to pay rent, staff, and make a profit.
Each layer has to eat. And the de minimis rule means the factory can ship a single bolt directly to you and skip every one of those layers tax-free. It's not that the local store is bad at what it does. It's that the playing field is tilted at an angle that's physically impossible to stand on.
So where does that leave the ethical question Daniel's asking? If the economics are this lopsided, are we just watching the slow extinction of a business model that doesn't make sense anymore?
This is where I think we need to sit with the discomfort rather than resolve it too quickly. The ethical question has two genuine sides. On one hand, efficiency is a real good. Lower prices mean people can afford more with the same income. That's not trivial for someone doing home repairs on a tight budget, saving $9 on fasteners matters. And the variety means projects get done right instead of bodged together with whatever the local store had in stock.
The bodging together part is real. I've got a shelf held up by drywall anchors that are definitely not rated for what's on them because that's what the store had.
And someday that shelf will have a story to tell. But on the other hand, the local hardware store isn't just a vending machine for screws. It's a place where you can walk in and say, "My sink is making a noise," and someone will tell you it's probably the cartridge, and here's how to replace it. That knowledge is real value, and it's not priced into the transaction.
Though Daniel's experience suggests that knowledge isn't always on offer. The grumpy clerk wasn't dispensing wisdom.
Fair, and that's part of the structural problem. If the transaction is unprofitable, the store can't afford to staff it with knowledgeable people. The expertise walks out the door because the margins can't support it, and then the customer experience gets worse, and then more customers go online. It's a spiral.
So let's talk about the point of acceptance. Daniel's asking, is there a threshold where we just say, look, this category of retail doesn't work anymore?
I think there is, and I think we've crossed it for certain niches. Fasteners are close to the purest case. They're standardized, they're small, they're non-urgent for most buyers, and the local purchasing experience is often worse than online. If a product category meets all four of those criteria, the store selling is probably doomed regardless of how we feel about it.
The standardization part is key. A fastener is a fastener. An M6 bolt from AliExpress is functionally identical to an M6 bolt from the hardware store. This isn't like produce where freshness matters, or clothing where fit matters. It's a commodity.
And commodities migrate to the lowest cost channel. That's been true for centuries. The question isn't whether it happens, it's what we do about the people and communities caught in the transition.
Which brings us to the regulatory piece. Governments are starting to push back. What's actually happening?
The EU has been the most aggressive. They've proposed eliminating the de minimis exemption for e-commerce platforms entirely, and they've imposed new tariffs specifically targeting Temu and AliExpress shipments. The argument is twofold: consumer protection. A lot of those ultra-cheap products don't meet EU safety standards, and leveling the playing field for domestic retailers.
Does it work?
It raises prices for consumers. That's the trade-off, and it's one governments are increasingly willing to make. But here's the thing. Even with tariffs, the underlying efficiency gap doesn't go away. A 20% tariff on a $3 set of fasteners brings it to $360. The local store is still charging $12. The tariff narrows the gap but doesn't close it.
So tariffs are a tourniquet, not a cure.
They buy time, and time might be valuable if you're using it to figure out what local retail actually looks like in 10 years. But if the strategy is just make Chinese imports more expensive and hope the problem goes away, that's not a strategy. That's denial.
There was a case in Spain recently. A shop owner publicly challenged Temu over their pricing. What was that about?
A small retailer in Spain essentially called out Temu for selling products below what he could buy them wholesale. He wasn't asking for special treatment. He was pointing out that the structural advantages had gotten so extreme that he couldn't even compete as a buyer, let alone as a seller. A consumer could buy a single unit from Temu for less than he could buy 1,000 units from his distributor.
That's a pretty clean illustration of the problem. When the retail price to the consumer is below the wholesale price to the retailer has no reason to exist.
And that's not hyperbole. That's the actual math in certain product categories. The Spanish shop owner wasn't complaining about tough competition. He was documenting a structural impossibility.
So if we accept that certain stores are inherently inefficient, that the fastener store as we know it can't survive, what does a viable replacement path look like? Daniel asked that directly.
I think there are a few models that make sense, and they're not mutually exclusive. The first is specialization in things online can't do, a hardware store that focuses on advice, custom work, and immediacy. You don't go there for a bag of screws. You go there because you need a pipe threaded, or a piece of glass cut to size, or someone to look at your broken lock and tell you what to buy. The screws are almost a side business.
So the store becomes a service business that happens to sell some products, rather than a product business that happens to offer some service.
That's the pivot. And it's not easy. Service businesses have different economics, different staffing needs, but it's at least a model where the local presence adds value that a warehouse in Shenzhen can't replicate.
What about the hybrid approach? Local stores as pickup points or showrooms for online orders?
That's already happening in some places. The store stocks a curated selection of fast-moving items for emergency purchases, and everything else is ordered through an in-store kiosk or a partnership with a larger supplier. The store gets a commission, the customer gets the convenience of local pickup, and the inventory risk is offloaded. It's not glamorous, but it keeps a physical presence in the community.
It also keeps jobs, which is part of what Daniel's worried about. Though the jobs change, you need fewer people and different skills.
The third model that's interesting is community-owned co-ops. If the hardware store is a community asset, if people value it beyond the transactions, then the community can own it. There are towns where the last grocery store closed and residents formed a co-op to reopen it. The economics still have to work, but the profit threshold is lower because there's no owner extracting returns. It just needs to break even.
I've seen that work for bookstores. A town decides the bookstore is worth keeping. They set up a membership model, and it limps along at break-even because people value the space. But books have cultural cachet. Fasteners are a harder sell for that kind of sentiment.
They are, and that's the real test. People will rally to save a bookstore. Will they rally to save a fastener store? Probably not, even though the fastener store might be more useful day-to-day.
This connects to something Daniel mentioned, the broader pattern. This isn't unique to hardware. Automation and supply chain efficiency have hollowed out other retail categories already.
Bookstores were the canary. Amazon didn't just undercut them on price, it offered an infinite catalog that no physical store could match. The independent bookstores that survived did it by becoming community spaces, curating selection, hosting events. They added value beyond the transaction.
Electronics retail went the same way. Remember when every town had a Radio Shack? You could walk in and buy a capacitor or a weird adapter. Now you order it online, and the store is a T-Mobile franchise or a vape shop.
Radio Shack is actually the perfect parallel to the fastener store. They stock thousands of low-margin components, resistors, connectors, switches, that sat in drawers for months. The inventory costs were brutal, the staff had to be knowledgeable enough to help, and the average transaction was tiny. When online came for them, there was nothing to defend. The business model was already fragile.
Yet people were sad when Radio Shack closed. There's a nostalgia for the place, even from people who hadn't set foot in one for years.
That's the tension Daniel's getting at. The nostalgia is real, the community value is real, but neither of them pays the rent. You can't run a business on sentiment.
The ethical question reframes. It's not, should we preserve inefficient stores out of obligation? It's, if these stores are going to disappear, what do we owe the people and communities affected, and how do we design what comes next?
I think we owe an honest conversation, at minimum. Not pretending that tariffs will bring back the 1980s hardware store. Not pretending that the efficiency gains aren't real benefits to consumers. But also not pretending that the transition is costless or that markets handle it gracefully on their own.
Markets are terrible at graceful transitions. They're efficient at allocating resources, but they don't do funerals. The store closes, the owner retires or finds other work, the building sits empty for a while, and the community adjusts. The market doesn't care that people liked having the store there.
That's where policy might have a role that isn't just protectionist tariffs. If we accept that certain retail categories are going to consolidate or disappear, we can plan for it. Retraining programs, small business transition loans, zoning that encourages new uses for commercial space. Not trying to freeze the current landscape in place, but making the change less brutal.
The Spanish shop owner would probably say that's nice in theory, but doesn't help him this year.
He'd be right. And that's the gap between policy and reality. Policy moves in years. A small business can fail in months.
Let me push on something you said earlier. You mentioned that even with tariffs, the efficiency gap doesn't close. But isn't the point of tariffs to change behavior, not to equalize prices? If a 20% tariff makes some consumers think twice and buy locally, that's a win for the policy, even if the price gap remains.
That's fair, and there's evidence that even small price changes shift behavior at the margins. The question is whether the shift is enough to sustain the local business, or whether it just slows the decline by a few years. My read of the numbers is that it slows the decline. The underlying cost structure is too different.
We're managing the decline rather than reversing it.
I think that's the honest framing. And managing decline is actually a legitimate policy goal. It gives communities time to adapt, it gives workers time to transition, it avoids the shock of sudden closures. But it's important to be clear, that's what we're doing, not pretend we're saving the hardware store for all time.
Daniel's prompt also gestures at something I want to name directly. He said small hardware stores are tangible in a way that many are not. I think he's saying that when a fastener store closes, you see it. It's on the main street. You walk past the empty window. Whereas when a data entry job gets automated, nobody walks past an empty cubicle.
Visibility matters for political attention. The factory closure gets news coverage and government response. The gradual hollowing out of small retail, a store here, a store there, over a decade, is less dramatic but cumulatively may be larger. And because it's not concentrated in one industry or one region, there's no organized political response.
The electrician Daniel talked to probably doesn't think of himself as part of a trend. He just knows where to get the parts he needs.
Right. And from his perspective, the system is working. He gets better parts cheaper with less hassle. The fact that a store owner somewhere is struggling doesn't enter his calculus, and it's not obvious that it should. He's running a small business himself. He's making rational purchasing decisions.
Which is why the ethical question is hard. Nobody's doing anything wrong. The electrician isn't betraying his community by buying bolts online. The store owner isn't lazy or incompetent. The Chinese factory isn't evil. It's a system producing an outcome that nobody specifically chose.
That's the thing about structural change. It doesn't have a villain. It has incentives, and the incentives all point in one direction.
Before we write the obituary for the hardware store, Hilbert's got a case to make.
I want to push on the framing here, because I think you've both been a little too comfortable with the idea that efficiency is the metric that matters. You keep saying the fastener store is inherently inefficient, and you've built a whole case around that. But inefficient at what? Making money on 7-cent screws? Sure. Being there when someone's kitchen sink is flooding at 9 p.m. on a Saturday? AliExpress can't do that. Can't do it at any price.
That's a real point. The emergency use case is genuine.
It's not just emergencies. It's the accumulated knowledge of a place, the hardware store owner who's seen every plumbing disaster in a 50-year-old house and can tell you what you actually need versus what you think you need. That knowledge isn't price per transaction, but it has value. You both mentioned this earlier and then kind of set it aside.
We set it aside because the store Daniel described didn't have that. It had a grumpy clerk who didn't want to be there.
One store, one experience. You're generalizing from Daniel's bad afternoon to an entire category. The Spanish shop owner you mentioned, he's not grumpy, he's fighting. He knows his products, he knows his customers, and he's being undercut by a platform that doesn't pay the same taxes or follow the same safety regulations. That's not an efficiency story. That's a regulatory arbitrage story.
The regulatory arbitrage is real, I'll grant that. The de minimis rule and the postal subsidies aren't market efficiency, they're policy choices.
Right. So when you say the store is structurally inefficient, you're smuggling in a policy environment as if it's a law of nature. Change the policy, enforce the same safety standards, collect the same taxes, eliminate the postal subsidies, and the efficiency gap shrinks dramatically. Maybe the store still loses, but it's a fair fight, not a rigged one.
That's a fair push. The playing field isn't just tilted. It's actively tilted by specific policy decisions.
My second point is about what you called the point of acceptance. You said we've crossed it for fasteners, but who's we? The consumer making a rational purchase? The store owner losing their livelihood? The town that loses another storefront? Those are different we's with different thresholds. The consumer accepts it long before the community does, and the community's acceptance might never come. It might just be a loss that's never fully processed.
That's actually a more nuanced way of putting it than I did. The acceptance isn't uniform.
My strongest case is this. Efficiency is a narrow lens, and you're both smart enough to know it. A town with empty storefronts is less efficient at being a town. People who know their neighbors because they see them at the hardware store, that's social capital, and it has economic value even if it doesn't show up on a balance sheet. AliExpress delivers a bolt. It doesn't deliver a community. And before you say that's sentimental, I'm not arguing from nostalgia. I'm arguing that some things we value don't price well. And efficiency, as a framework, is terrible at capturing them.
I don't disagree with the diagnosis. I think where we part ways is on what follows from it. Acknowledging that the store has non-transactional value doesn't change the transaction math that's killing it. The social capital is real, but it doesn't pay the wholesaler.
No, but it might justify a different policy response. If the value is real and unpriced, maybe the community should price it, through subsidies, through tax breaks, through the co-op model Herman mentioned. Not as charity, but as payment for services rendered.
That's a coherent position. The question is whether voters will accept it. Subsidizing hardware stores is a harder political sell than subsidizing farms or steel mills.
Maybe. But the alternative is watching them close and then wondering why main streets feel dead. I'm not saying I have the answer. I'm saying the efficiency story is too tidy, and you both know it.
The tidiness was probably the problem. The real situation is messier, and maybe that's the point.
I think where we land is unsettled. The efficiency argument is real. The supply chain advantages are structural, and they're not going away. But Hilbert's right that efficiency isn't the only lens, and policy choices created a lot of the gap. The question isn't whether local retail changes. It's changing. The question is whether we manage the change or just let it happen and sort out the consequences later.
The fastener store on the corner. The one with the grumpy clerk and the 7-cent screws. It's a small thing, but it's standing in for a much bigger question about what we want our commercial landscape to look like. Daniel's right that I prefer buying in person is a weak counter-argument to the efficiency question. But I value having a place where someone knows what I need before I do. That's a stronger one, and it's not easily priced.
The replacement paths we talked about, service-focused stores, hybrid pickup models, co-ops, they all require some version of that value to be recognized and paid for. If it's not recognized, the stores close. If it is, they might find a new shape.
That's probably where we leave it. Not resolved, but with a clearer sense of what's actually at stake.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing and for pushing back where it needed pushing. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you've got a weird prompt about the future of retail, or work, or anything else that's been rattling around your head, send it to us. show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.